Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from The Voice of America. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear a story from Anna Mateo and Jonathan Evans. Later, Steve Ember will bring us this week's Making of a Nation report. But first, the victory of Donald Trump in the 2016 presidential election came as a surprise to many people in the United States. Most political observers predicted Trump would lose the election to Hillary Clinton. But he won, in large part because of older male voters. However, other groups did not share in that support. One of them was American college students, mostly female students. In fact, a new study found that more first-year female students at U.S. colleges and universities now identify themselves as liberal than ever before. It also suggests the difference in the number of all first-year female and male students identifying as liberal is the biggest ever measured. The study comes from the Higher Education Research Institute at UCLA, the University of California in Los Angeles. Researchers launched the study in 1966. They ask first-time, full-time students at four-year colleges and universities around the country about different subjects. Last year, the study gathered information from over 137,000 students at 184 different schools. One of the subjects the study asks about is U.S. politics. The study asks college students to identify themselves politically in one of five groupings. They are liberal, extreme liberal or far left, conservative, extreme conservative or far right, and moderate or middle of the road. Since the beginning of the study, moderate students have always been, and still are, the largest group. But in 2016, 41.1% of the female students in the study identified themselves as liberal or far left. This is the largest percentage of young women identifying as liberal in the over 50-year history of the study. By comparison, just 28.9% of males identified their political thinking as liberal or far left. Around 27% of male students and about 18% of female students identified themselves as conservative or far right.
Kevin Egan is an assistant professor at UCLA. He also is the managing director of the Higher Education Research Institute. He says the number of female college students identifying as liberal has been rising since the 1990s. There have been periods when male students were more liberal than females, such as during the 1960s and 1970s. But Egan notes the number of young people identifying with one party over another has a lot to do with the politicians who represent those parties. For example, the Republican Party chose former California Governor Ronald Reagan as its presidential candidate in 1980. Reagan was elected and served 8 years in the White House. Information collected during that period showed large decreases in the number of liberal college students. Kevin Egan believes that many young women likely identified with Hillary Clinton last year because she was a woman. Clinton was the presidential candidate of the Democratic Party, which has supported more liberal policies in recent years than the Republicans. Egan says Trump also likely pushed women to the left through his actions and statements about women. For example, during the 2016 election campaign, news media uncovered a recording of Trump from several years earlier. In the recording, he made jokes about inappropriate contact with women. Several other women came forward and accused him of sexual wrongdoing. Trump and his campaign denied the sexual misconduct claims. But college student Nesha Ruther says she does not identify as liberal simply because the more liberal presidential candidate was a woman. Ruther is from Tacoma Park, Maryland. She began taking classes at the University of Wisconsin in 2016. She is a registered Democrat. Ruther wanted Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders to serve as the party's candidate last November. She says she did so because of his support of issues like ending police violence against African Americans and raising taxes on the wealthy. After Sanders lost the nomination to Clinton, Ruther grew concerned about Trump's calls to limit public money for health care services that mainly serve women. She also opposed his calls to restrict medical operations for ending a pregnancy. So the Maryland woman supported Clinton's candidacy. Ruther argues that many women choose to identify as liberal because of their position on issues that most affect them. This includes making sure women are paid the same as men for the same work, and that women should be included in making decisions on rules affecting reproductive health.
Hans Knoll teaches political science at Georgetown University in Washington, D.C. He notes that liberals are not the majority among American women. In fact, the Washington Post newspaper reported that 61% of white women without a college degree voted for Trump. But many more young women in recent years identify themselves as feminists and support politicians who support women's rights. Knoll adds that colleges and universities are often places that support more liberal ways of thinking. And it is almost natural that young women would side with whatever political movement they feel most supports their needs.
Now, the VOA Learning English program, Words and Their Stories. On this weekly show, we tell about commonly used American expressions. By knowing these expressions, you can improve your ability to speak and understand American English.
Today, we go deep into the high seas to meet one of the most feared hunters in the ocean, the shark. Sharks are large, usually gray, saltwater fish. Unlike other creatures, They have a skeleton made of cartilage, not bones. Sharks also have sharp teeth. They are known for being dangerous and eating whatever they want.
That's in the water. On land, Americans use the word shark in a number of expressions. The word shark can be used to describe someone who is tricky and uses other people.
An example of this is the term loan shark. Loan sharks are people, not fish. They loan money at very high interest rates to others who need the money badly. A shark can also be someone who is very good at something. However, they often use their skill to trick others. Sometimes we use this version of shark as a verb.
For example, let's say you are skilled at playing the game of pool, also known as pocket billiards. In fact, you never lose a game. One night, you go to a pool hall and act like you are not a good player. You miss shot after shot on purpose. You invite another person to play a game. You play against them and lose. Then you ask them to give you another chance. Not only that, you offer them money if they beat you a second time. Your opponent happily accepts and, to be fair to you, makes the same offer. But you defeat them and win all the money. In a situation like this, you are a pool shark and have sharked your opponent.
If you are swimming with sharks in the ocean, you might be in serious danger. And if you are swimming with sharks on land, you are spending time with the wrong crowd.
Let's go back to the pool hall and our story about the pool shark. Imagine that the people whose money you won are not the nicest. They are criminals who are now angry at you for winning their money. You could say, based on this example, you are swimming with sharks.
If the sharks are circling, then someone is in danger and their enemies are preparing for the kill. When sharks smell blood in the water, they come and circle the wounded animal. The same can be said for people. Let's say you are at work and experience bad luck on a project or two. You are in danger of losing your job. Your coworkers may smell blood in the water. You could say the sharks have started circling. In this example, your mistakes are the blood, and the sharks are your coworkers.
On the other hand, someone who is shark bait is not dangerous, just the opposite. Shark bait is one way of describing a person who swims in the ocean alone. For people who live at the beach, shark bait can also be an expression for someone who gets sunburned easily because they are not used to the bright sun.
But for everyone else, shark bait describes someone who is unsuspecting and easy to trick. Two great words that mean shark bait are naive and gullible.
I'm Anna Mateo.
And I'm Jonathan Evans.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember. This week in our series, we continue the story of the presidency of George W. Bush. Bush began his second term and fifth year in office in January 2005. Early in his first term, terrorists had carried out the worst attacks in United States history. President Bush declared a war on terror and led the country into wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. In his second inaugural address, he promised to continue fighting to defeat terrorism and increase democracy around the world.
So it is the policy of the United States to seek and support the growth of democratic movements and institutions in every nation and culture with the ultimate goal of ending tyranny in our world.
He also talked about his goals at home and what he called America's ideal of freedom.
In America's ideal of freedom, citizens find the dignity and security of economic independence instead of laboring on the edge of subsistence. This is the broader definition of liberty that motivated the Homestead Act, the Social Security Act, and the GI Bill of Rights. We will widen the ownership of homes and businesses, retirement savings, and health insurance, preparing our people for the challenges of life in a free society by making every citizen an agent of his or her own destiny. We will give our fellow Americans greater freedom from want and fear and make our society more prosperous and just and equal.
The United States Constitution limits presidents to two terms. Presidential historian Russell Riley at the University of Virginia's Miller Center says presidents traditionally use their first term to focus on their major goals for the country. Second terms, he says, tend to be unhappy times. During his second term, Richard Nixon resigned over the attempt to hide political wrongdoing in the Watergate case. Bill Clinton faced a trial in the Senate over his attempt to hide a relationship with a young aide. But the first major problem of George Bush's second term dropped from the sky.
You saw people on the rooftops. You saw people using claw hammers trying to break through their attic to get up onto the roof. That's why you had so many people who drowned.
In August of 2005, Susan Bennett received a phone call from her daughter, a television reporter in New Orleans, Louisiana.
She called on a Friday and said, "I think you need to come and pick up my son because there's a really big storm coming."
It was Hurricane Katrina, one of the worst natural disasters in American history. Along the Gulf of Mexico, the hardest hit states were Louisiana, Mississippi, and Alabama. Over 1,800 people died. Property damage totaled more than $75 billion. But Katrina will be remembered mostly because of what happened in New Orleans.
They just gutted the hotel!
A day before the storm hit, officials had ordered everyone to leave the city. But thousands of people stayed. Some chose not to leave. Others were too poor, too old, or too sick to go. Then the levees broke. Those flood barriers were supposed to protect the city. Much of New Orleans was built on land that lies below sea level.
Go on, sir.
As Katrina hit, more than 80% of the city flooded. In some areas, the water was 6 meters deep. Many people who stayed were caught in the floods. Officials struggled to get food, water, and medicine to the survivors. The displaced included thousands of people who took shelter in the Superdome, a big sports arena. Out on the streets, lawless acts fed a sense of disorder and helplessness.
It's disgusting and frustrating, and we are human beings, and they're treating us like we're criminals.
We want help! Help us!
Susan Bennett helped create an exhibit about Hurricane Katrina at the museum, a museum of news in Washington.
Not only in this country, but also in newspapers across the world, you saw the same headline. It ranged from engulfed to our tsunami, chaos, and then it went to anarchy, national disgrace.
Congress later found that officials at every level of government, local, state, and federal, had failed in doing their jobs. President Bush flew over New Orleans to inspect the damage. A photograph showed him looking out the window of Air Force One at the ground below. Russell Riley at the University of Virginia says the picture expressed what many people were thinking about the handling of the disaster.
Because of the ineffectiveness of the government response at the time, that image communicated to the American people that the president was remote, that he wasn't on the ground, that the best he could do was just look out the window of a passing plane.
In 2005, a different kind of storm was hitting Iraq. American and Iraqi officials were struggling to create a democratic government. Local militias were on the rise and attacking coalition forces and other Iraqis. The violence also included Al-Qaeda suicide bombings in Iraq, which angered many Iraqis. And there was international anger as the result of photos that showed American troops abusing Iraqi prisoners. President Bush had declared the end of major combat operations on May 1, 2003. That was less than 2 months after the invasion. But the numbers of civilian and military deaths were growing. And in the United States, surveys were showing that a growing number of Americans thought going into Iraq was a mistake.
The bad news was we were uncomfortable with it, and we wanted to get out, and we could not understand how things could go so terribly wrong.
Judith Yaffe joined the National Defense University after 20 years as a Middle East expert at the Central Intelligence Agency.
That's where the lack of strategy and the mismanagement come in. But I think it's also true that, you know, Americans just wanted to say, why are we in Iraq? Why are we in any of these places? Because historically speaking, it's not a role we've been comfortable with.
She says by President Bush's second term, few Iraqis wanted to cooperate with the Americans to make the country more secure. But President Bush said American troops could not leave until Iraqi forces replaced them. In 2006, an Iraqi court sentenced the country's former leader to death. Saddam Hussein was hanged for crimes against humanity. But nothing else seemed to change. Violence and insurgent attacks continued. Iraq seemed to be on the edge of being torn apart by civil war. Early the next year, President Bush announced that he was sending more troops to Iraq. He thought it would help stop the violence.
These troops will work alongside Iraqi units and be embedded in their formations. Our troops will have a well-defined mission to help Iraqis clear and secure neighborhoods, to help them protect the local population, and to help ensure that the Iraqi forces left behind are capable of providing the security that Baghdad needs.
The temporary increase of about 30,000 troops came to be called the surge. In September of 2007, the top commander in Iraq reported to Congress that the violence was decreasing. The surge may have helped create the conditions for this change, but there were other reasons as well. Middle East expert Judith Yaffe says many Iraqis decided to work with the Americans to defeat the insurgency.
The real truth is, and it's a good news story, that the Iraqis themselves saw that this was a greater danger to them, that there was nothing to be gained. The Sunnis of Iraq in particular saw that Al-Qaeda was hurting them, that it was a danger to them, that there was much more to be gained by aligning with the U.S. forces.
By the time President Bush was finishing his second term, Iraqi and American officials had agreed on a withdrawal date to end the war. The last American forces would leave Iraq by the end of 2011. Russell Riley at the University of Virginia says, "It is too soon to know how history will judge the United States' actions in Iraq."
If Iraq proves to be a policy success, then the surge will be a critical turning point and a terrific exercise of presidential leadership.
He also points out that the war is not the only measure by which the 43rd president will be judged. Professor Riley put it this way: "The great debate among historians will not be whether Bush was a powerful president or a consequential president, but whether he directed those powers in the most fruitful way that he could have." So what else was going on in the United States during this period? Millions of people were voting for which singer should get a recording contract on American Idol. Year after year, it was the most popular show on television.
Oh, Robert, I think you just killed my favorite song of all time.
Killed in a good way or a bad way?
I'm afraid. Well, listen, killing is never good.
Killing is never good.
There's never a happy killing.
I'm sorry to hear that.
No, I mean, that was first degree on that one.
I need some shelter, my own protection, baby.
But the biggest story in music was not what people were listening to, but how. Sales of CDs in stores fell as more and more people downloaded songs from the internet. On iTunes, Fergie's Big Girls Don't Cry was the most downloaded song of 2007.
And big girls don't cry.
For the first half of the decade, there seemed to be nothing to cry about in the American housing market. Home prices were going up and up, which made sellers happy. And lenders were offering bigger and bigger loans at easy terms and low interest rates, which made buyers happy. The government supported the easing of lending rules as a form of social policy, a way to help more people buy homes. Rates of home ownership, a part of the American dream, reached record highs. In 2005, nearly 7 out of 10 Americans owned their own home. But many home buyers had been given mortgage loans that they could not afford to pay back. And that was not the only problem. Banks had been selling those loans as securities to investors around the world. Everyone thought they were getting a good deal. The banks, the borrowers, the investors. But then the price bubble burst and the housing market collapsed. Many borrowers lost their homes because they were unable to make their monthly loan payments. That was the situation Karen Lucas and her husband of Cleveland, Ohio, found themselves in.
I've done my crying. I've made my peace, and I've put it in God's hands.
As home values fell, many people found themselves underwater, meaning they owed more on their mortgage than their house was worth. Suddenly, there was a lot to cry about. By the end of 2007, the economy was sliding into the Great Recession. That and the election of 2008 will be our story next week.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy.